Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. How are you doing?
Hi, Dave. It's Stephanie. I'm well. How are you?
Welcome. Great. Thanks for your prompt. Who else is here?
It's Grace. I'm here. How are you?
Grace, welcome. Well, let's start with wins or progress notes or anything that you'd like to discuss. Anything remaining as questions or from your clients or from the curriculum that you're reading?
Well, if no one else has a question, I'll ask
you. Got it. Go ahead.
I was just reading before this session. I was just reading the module 4 about the state of mind. And on a page 4.5, you mentioned something about the psychotherapist hearing someone speak about the fear of public speaking and then also a professional coach. I don't quite see the difference that you're trying to show, the difference between the psychotherapist's approach and a professional coach's. I understand the professional coach, but the psychotherapist, how to differentiate that clearly from a professional coach about hearing someone's fear about public speaking?
Okay, that doesn't sound very clear. I wanted to emphasize the distinction of some therapeutic approaches about really understanding the dynamics, the cause, the underpinnings, the developmental issues, the kind of conflicts that interfere, and resolving the conflicts as a way of proceeding, and to understand the problems and work through the issues that are barriers, as opposed to a coaching perspective of the choice architecture of this moment, of looking at possibilities, not exploring problems, not exploring why, but looking at the issues right now and the choices going forward and what's going to facilitate the next step.
Yeah.
So it's a distinction of possibility from problem about now versus understanding precedent. And there's also I mentioned this before, and you probably already have it. There's a white paper on the homepage of my website that is about distinguishing therapy from coaching. It's down in the bottom right where you sign up for the newsletter, and it's one of the two white papers that you can download. And
thank you. I will download that.
Yeah, some more specifics about the distinction of therapy and coaching. So that's a good question, and from that passage, that wasn't all that clear. So I'm glad you raised it, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for your clarification.
Absolutely. What else? What else would be helpful for us to talk about? Have you begun to work with clients in any different ways since we've begun this now?
Well, that doesn't apply to me since I don't have clients yet.
Okay.
I'm hoping by the first of the year I will be able to launch a website and begin something, practicing.
Okay. May I coach you for a moment?
Yes.
I hear a belief. I believe from what I heard you say that you have to have things in place like a website before you begin working with
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yes.
What do you think about that assumption?
I guess I feel insecure, don't know what to do, being that this is such new waters for me. It's like, what do I do? Where do I begin?
Okay. Would you like to work with me out loud for just a couple of minutes on that question?
Okay. All right.
Okay.
You know, I was exploring this on my own over the weekend. Over the weekend. I was thinking, when I first started my real estate brokerage, it was so simple. You get a phone, you get an office, You advertise, you get clients, next thing you know, you have an exploding business. But life is so different now. It's all high-tech things, like...
No, you're a son. May I interrupt you?
Yes,
that's
please.
Always an agreement I have with every client, so that when something I believe that can be usefully focused on at the moment, so that we can focus on that. I hear you making it complicated. It could be as simple as how you started with real estate. You know, all you need to start your coaching business are three things: a business card, a telephone, ideally a landline and headset, and a story. That's all you need.
Okay.
And that means that you could start your coaching business first thing in the morning instead of waiting until January. In fact, a website is one of the last things that you need and not one of the first many things that I would recommend that you do to start a coaching business. I didn't have a website for the first year and a half of my coaching business, and I saw a number of clients. Anything that you do, and here's all I would suggest that you have in place to start. One is, you know, a business card, a telephone, and a couple of things. One is a client information packet, and you have a copy of one that you can use verbatim in the curriculum. It's
yes.
In the resources
at
the addendum.
I saw it. Yes, thank you.
I would suggest using something like that, whatever your version of it is, with your heading, your coaching name and firm, and sending it as an attachment, getting somebody to send it back to you, having a business credit card and a business checking account, and that's all you need.
Okay. I have to find some clients.
Well, that's the thing that you can begin in the morning. Here's what I would suggest for that.
Okay.
The usual idea about creating a niche is to ask, what am I passionate about? What have I had experience in? What have I had training, special skills, and a real interest in? Who do I want to spend my professional day with? All the usual things about a niche. The other consideration that I would suggest starting with is, where's your lowest hanging fruit? Who are the
where's what? Oh, your lowest hanging
your
fruit?
Your lowest hanging fruit. The people who you already know, who you can announce that you're starting your practice.
Okay.
And send out on letterhead a letter of announcement and indicate that you do a free sample session, if you do that, for anyone they would refer to you to referral sources. And the same letter, except a different ending to a potential client, to say you're interested in getting an idea of what it would be like to work together in coaching, to do, I would offer to schedule a free sample session and leave your number. And send out maybe a dozen a day and do follow-up so that you can do follow-up by telephone, even if it's for people out of town, and do it maybe 4 or 5 days after you do the mailing, so you're sure they got it. Now, you told me the reason that you have not proceeded. It has nothing to do with the website. You told me what the actual reason was when you said that you felt insecure and you didn't know what to do. Now, it makes sense to say I got to wait for a website, but
yeah.
a website is one of the very last things I would do. If we were to talk about marketing, the first thing I would think about doing is a blog. But here's the, and we've touched on this before, but here's what's the essence of what I hear, and I say this without doing it in a coaching mode so that each of you can get an idea of how I'd be thinking about it. There are two basic forces that we have in our human psyche. One is to seek pleasure. The other is to avoid pain. Now, any time that we have a surface story, I really want to proceed, I want to generate more income and create wealth, or I want to get my coaching practice started. If there is a plan, that's the first question. if we were doing mentor coaching, I'd say, what's your plan? What's your business plan? What's your plan to, you know, stepwise over the next several weeks? If you have a plan and you're still not proceeding, then I would want to look at what your the two basic motivations to avoid pain, to seek pleasure. What pain do you assume you're avoiding by not starting, by not initiating something? And you started out with that. I'm avoiding the pain of feeling insecure, of not knowing what I want to do, of leaving my comfort zone. I back away from this. So I do nothing, and at least I'm not in as acute a pain. Now,
yes.
From a coaching perspective, what we might do is one of two things or both. One is, what's the greater pain if you don't proceed? Because and the answer is, you'll still be having this conversation in December and January and February.
Right.
And what will it cost you over the next 6 months if you don't proceed? What's the greater pain 6 months from now, a year from now, 2 years?
Yeah. Oh, that's awful. Yeah.
And
the greater pain is
the
depression of...
If you do proceed with your plan. So the greater pain if you continue to avoid, the greater pleasure if you do proceed. So that's a here and now approach focused on fundamental psychodynamics, but not in a therapeutic way, in a coaching way. So I'm trying to answer your earlier question and say what I would think about saying if we were doing mentor coaching together. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I thank you so much for calling me on that.
So what do you commit to do this week before we meet again to further your coaching business?
Okay, I will at least do that business plan you sent as a template about that. So
okay.
I should have a plan. And I shall make some announcement. I thought that
I'm
will...
Just a second. I want to interrupt you again. I'm
vague. Go ahead.
When you say make some announcements. What does that mean?
Okay. All right. I will send 5 announcements before our next meeting.
Okay. May I challenge you to make it 12?
Okay.
And will that be a letter, a hard copy letter on your letterhead?
You know how silly is this? I have an old letterhead from my Grace Hogshead Realty, but I am not set up for my new life yet.
Okay.
So I don't even have a new letterhead. That's terrible.
Okay.
But
I hear that, and that's not a rate-limiting factor. You can do that in a couple of days. Do you still commit to do 12 announcements?
I do.
Sent out
by the
next time we meet?
Yes.
On your letterhead?
Yes.
On your new letterhead?
I will get a new letterhead.
And send out the announcements by the time we meet again?
Yes, except that I will be out of town and I won't join you guys for that next session. Remember, I said I'll be out of town and I'm returning on Monday. But
will you send me an email so I can announce it to the class?
Okay.
That you put
I will do that.
Commitment to yourself made out loud to all of us to hear.
Okay.
That's a deal. Thank you for doing that with me, Grace. I mean, that's exactly how it would work with somebody. Now I'm assuming that we have a reasonable enough working alliance. I would make sure that I have enough of a working alliance with a client that I can get away with being bold and slapping somebody around like that, because that's,
yeah, but
you
we
know.
Need, you know, I mean, people in my situation, and I feel like, God, I'm trying to be a coach, and I need to be coached, you know, because it's this maneuvering into this new life that just seems so uncomfortable.
Exactly.
I could look back. I even was looking back, like I said, God, why was it so simple? And why is it not simple now, yet the way you bring it the way you present it to me is exactly as simple as it was.
You create the story. You can make it a simple story or a complex story. It's not there until you write it.
Yeah.
And it's written in exactly the way that you decide. Whatever you think and feel and experience is what you create. And whatever you experience, you either accept or create.
Yes.
And I would suggest that each of you get a mentor coach if it's at all possible for you, because I think it can be a huge return on investment of just meeting for a month or two to jumpstart your practices and get things going and really begin to generate some serious income and have a much more evolved experience of this training to really put it into play with clients, individual, group, whatever you decide. So thank you for...
Yeah,
for
thank you. Me. Thank you so much, Dave.
Absolutely, absolutely. Does anybody else dare now? any other comments or questions or things you'd like to talk about?
This is Anne Marie. Thank you. I wanted to thank Grace for putting herself out there like that. But
yeah,
also to
Grace
say,
told
I would,
that she
I,
didn't know she was going to be.
I feel like we're a little bit of kindred spirits here because I can relate a lot to what it is that you were saying and doing the, I will start when I feel more, I'll do this when I'm more comfortable or when I have this in place. So I was taking copious notes I've been doing this for over a year, and I still catch myself in those moments of holding myself, getting in my own way, basically. And this training has been hugely helpful. Dave, I feel like everything I've done in the last week, every thought process I've had, I've been asking myself, is that an old storyline, and what does the new storyline need to look like?
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. And let me expand a little bit on what you mentioned, since it's an almost ubiquitous experience for all of us. Anything that any time you hear a client talk about or for yourself, if there's anything that has to do with procrastination, and that's a great example of looking at those two basic motivations of avoiding pain and seeking pleasure, because there's almost always some pain that's anticipated that's being avoided, even though it may not make sense, even though it's not logical, even though you may not even be conscious of the pain that you anticipate. Because if you say, well, I want to generate more income and create wealth, well, it doesn't make any sense to say, well, I'm going to put off generating more income. I'm going to put off practicing professionally. I'm not going to start, making more money because, But then if you look closely, there's something there that's that shadow story, even if it's not conscious. Like, well, I'm not sure I'd know really what to do, or I'd be really uncomfortable leaving my comfort zone, or I don't think I have what it takes, or I'm just not sure. I don't like to do cold call, or whatever it is. Usually, a way that it manifests is some conversation internally, and we've talked about this just a little bit. What's the internal conversation the instant before you take that step to initiate doing what you do, if you have a plan? And again, that's an important if. Is it an internal bargaining? Like, well, I'm going to wait until next Tuesday, or I'm going to wait until I have a website, or I'm going to wait, I'm going to do it when. That's an internal bargaining. It sounds like it's proceeding, but it's really a way of making sense of stopping. Another is to get to the point, and again, the question is, what's the internal conversation the instant before you say no to your plan? Is it a defiance of your own authority? You say, the hell with it. I'm going to sit out by the pool and have a glass of wine, Or is it that you get kind of scattered and don't know what step to take, or you have too big a plan and it's some big you know, major plan, and you just simply need to shrink the change to what's the next step. You know, because it's like, well, I'm going to sit down and write a novel. Well, nobody in the history of the world has ever sat down to write a novel. You don't do that. You sit down, you write a number of pages, maybe you write a couple of pages, but if you sit down and write one page as a commitment, you write one page a day, at the end of the year, guess what? You have 365 pages, then you can start editing. But nobody sits down to write a novel. That's too big. It's kind of abstract to start with because a novel is a public book. Anyhow, you need to shrink the change, make it specific, focused, measurable, use your SMART goals, all the things that you know already. So you can do that with yourself. You can do that especially with your business. And it's a great place to start with your business.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for all of your comments and discussion about this. Any other thoughts or questions about this or any other aspect?
Well, I did want to add, Dave, that building on your comment of getting a mentor coach, this time last year was actually when I hired a mentor coach for myself, and it was after hearing it three different times. In three different CTA trainings, twice by you, actually, and I finally, after the third time, said, I need to do this, I want to do this, and I'm sure some of that was old storyline working in my head, too, and it has made a huge difference in my practice. And
well, I'm slipping a little bit if all three weren't from me, but I'm glad you did that, and that's great. That's great. Did you get somebody who's trained at CTA or somebody outside that system?
Not trained at CTA, but somebody who is a trainer at CTA. It's Deborah Brown Volkman.
Oh, terrific. Great, yeah.
Yeah.
She's super. That's nice.
And Grace, if there's an option for you to hire somebody for you, you know, to help you in your business and in your practice, I highly recommend the investment.
Yeah, I would do that.
Super. Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. Anything else that you'd like us to discuss before we move into the material? Okay, well, let's talk about mastering states of mind. This is Module 4. Now, I'd like you to imagine with me for a moment. Just close your eyes and imagine that you're at an auction. The room is filled with 75 sophisticated-looking people, business attire. The auctioneer walks in, holds a $100 bill before your group. He explains the auction scenario. Bids move in $5 increments. The highest bidder wins the bill. Second highest bidder pays the bid but gets nothing in return. And he reminds, this is real money, a real $100 bill. The auction begins. Within seconds, bids pass $100. Some of the 75 people push the bidding up to $300. Two people get into a bidding war. One of them ends up paying $465 for the $100 bill. The other writes a check for $460 and gets nothing. Now, how could reasonable people pay more for something than it's worth? Actually, this scenario has already happened. It's happened more than 600 times. The auctioneer, Professor Max Bazerman. The setting, Harvard's JFK School of Government. The participants, investment specialists and economic gurus, not undergraduates, not graduate students. Some of the brightest financial experts consistently pay 3 to 4 times the worth of the $100 bill just because of the way their minds work. Now, this isn't a stock whose perceived value is determined only by the bid. Professor Bazerman commented, I've never seen bidding stop below $100 in any of the more than 600 times I've done it. Now, what happened? What mind matters and brain business secrets are hiding in the open? Here's what we know. Oh, let me mention also, I have done this with a couple of groups. I've done this story with a couple of groups, and I've been approached afterwards by two different people, and these were, you know, financial people, who said, you know, Dave, that's exactly how it happened. I was in one of those auctions, And that's exactly how it happened. Neither one would admit where they stopped bidding. So here's what we know. One is the contributions from the mind. Loss aversion. I'm not going to be the second highest bidder, still pay and get nothing. Studies show how losing $100 makes us twice as unhappy as gaining $100 makes us happy. So we do things to avoid loss. Sunk cost fallacy. I've already bid $260. I'll just go $10 higher. We justify continuing because of what we've already put into it, the sunk cost. And notice something else, the segmentation. The focus is on the $10. I've been on boards of directors where this kind of thinking happens when someone mentions or advocates for a position that, well, we're just talking about X amount more. We're just talking about $10 more here. No, we're not talking about $10 more because that segments it. We're talking about the entire amount of the bid of $260 versus the bid of $270. And if you bid $270, you're not talking about $10. You're talking about $270. Now, here's some contribution from the brain. Prefrontal cortex says, stop at $95. Limbic system says, well, I'm excited. I'm going to win. I can't stop now. Our states of mind are vulnerable to emotional contagion. In that auction room, brains were on a collective tilt. The herd mentality was running wild. But now here's the conversation even without the contagion of other people. Prefrontal cortex says, let's save for retirement. Limbic system says, nah, let's have that second cognac and order the 27-inch iMac. Money behavior and financial decisions are sometimes, rarely, actually about money. If money were about math, no one would have personal debt. And $100 would simply be $100 instead of another number based on another state of mind. Here's one more brief scenario about how tilt can be contagious. 433 people voted on a proposal. It failed. If only 12 of those 433 people had voted yes instead of no, the outcome would have been exactly the opposite. The result? In the next 5 hours, the stock market lost $1.2 trillion. Here's what one senior equity trader on Wall Street said. You just felt like your world was unraveling. People started to sell, and they sold hard. It didn't matter what you had, you sold. And that's an expert. This collective tilt shows how states of mind are vulnerable to emotional contagion. This vote on the mortgage bailout in late 2008 crystallized an entire economic scenario of events, some of which we're actually still recovering from. Chuck Prince, the then head of Citigroup, said, as long as the music is playing, it's like you got to get up and dance. Greed, emotional contagion, and peer pressure trump logic. And when you see friends making significant profits or trading stock or flipping real estate, the natural inclination is to want in on the action. More join the movement, prices rise, and for a while, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But then some event reverses the momentum, bursts the bubble, turns optimism into panic. Herd mentality pushes people to join the momentum to buy or flee the market and sell. Now, people aren't stupid. They're just not regulated. They make mistakes. They buy low and sell high, either because they don't have a plan or they don't stick with it when emotion vaults beyond the fence of that plan, even when they're finance or economics experts. They pay $350 for a $100 bill, or, remember from before, over $6 for a stock they know is worth $3. Google announced its financial results in a fourth quarter on January 31st. Revenues were up 97%. Net profit up 82%, phenomenal growth. Yet Wall Street analysts had predicted even better. Their expectations were a penny over what the actual earnings were as a result Google stock lost $22.3 billion in value in a matter of minutes before trading was halted. And the only mistake was on the part of the analyst, but everybody got on that bandwagon. The great investment analyst, Benjamin Graham, was asked what it takes to be a successful investor. His response, people don't need extraordinary insight or intelligence. What they need most is the character to adopt simple rules and stick to them. Bazerman's auction is an example of creating a bubble. Bubbles are a market phenomenon in which value is inflated significantly beyond its basic worth, a collective tilt. So what we're talking about here is regulating states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. A state of mind is a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns, like a software program. A key element of coaching is helping a client at times become aware of various states of mind and focus on which state works best for what purpose. Here's an illustration of how states of mind are really like different software packages. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if before you teach it to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, so you simulate a stress-like state, teach the rat to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. Even though it has in a part of its brain the information about how to get to the cheese, it can't access it, and it can literally, in that maze, die of starvation. You re-inject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-dependent learning and state-dependent memory. A model of state of mind and regulation of states is the infant-adult interaction. In any moment, an infant is totally in one particular state. Contentment, upset, hunger, pain. The adult empathically resonates with this state in order to lend the function of regulation until the infant, if the infant is upset, until the infant's soothed. With time, as infants develop, they learn to moderate these all-or-nothing states of mind, to take in that regulation, to internally regulate. This attachment and borrowed regulation is internalized over time to become self-regulation. This is the analog, the foundation of collaboration and contingency among adults and among mentor coaches with clients. We engage in collaborative conversations with our clients and help them both understand and regulate states of mind. So coaching needs to be both heart-based and brain-based for a balanced learning and growth. And we now know that this collaborative communication and empathic connection creates new neural connections. So let's look at a mentor coaching application. It's important for us to hold the mind-body state of a client in order to understand their subjective experience as well as the story that they communicate. Now, developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally before the verbal linguistic abilities of the left brain mature. Most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness in a right brain to right brain communication of emotional states of both coach and client. The mentor coach must remain open to receiving communication from the client's right brain to become attuned to the state of mind of the client. This precedes synthesizing and planning. So once we're tuned into the client, we can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. So when we're grounded and centered, totally present, we have that empathic resonance and we have our intuitive capacity that's attuned to the client. So what we do then with the client is to creatively transform the experience into new ideas, co-creations beyond where either may have gone alone. So we need to hold, we need to allow and hold that communication, to hold unexplained experiences or feelings or ideas until a recognizable pattern emerges. This requires deep listening and attention at the same time to multiple levels of way of thinking and experiencing combined. It's the art and science of mentor coaching. Now, let's look at the neuro for a moment, the neuroscience of decision and conflict. You see a car swerving into your lane, headed directly for you. In a matter of seconds, your life could be over. As soon as you perceive the danger, you reflexively hit the brake pedal and horn and sharply turn the steering wheel. In a matter of seconds, your physiology has changed. You're exhausted, short of breath, heart racing. Emotional chemicals triggered by an automatic alarm reaction instantly change your state of mind to one of survival. Now, each thought and feeling has a chemical consequence. The chemicals of emotion alter mind and body, as you know. Personal experience determines what software program, what state of mind to use to process the data and how to respond. So when we see something that resembles a threat or danger, it instantly triggers an emotional and biochemical response within a fraction of a second. And remember how we talked about conversational intelligence, that the first few words of someone speaking boots up a particular state of mind in the listener, and that state then processes the remainder of that conversation. When there's incoming perception of a threat or danger, such as when the speaker is critical or judgmental or pejorative, it boots up that state of danger so that adrenaline and cortisol are mediating the response, and it affects the remainder of the conversation. Consider how it's different when there's the perception of collaboration, of connection, the chemical of connection, oxytocin, connection and bonding, then boots up an entire psychophysiological state that processes the remainder of that conversation. So that's what we do in working with clients. When somebody's upset or having an experience that takes them out of their comfort zone, we immediately want first to empathically resonate with their experience so that it does two things. One, it can be calming, and it creates a common ground to proceed. But first, it boots up a particular state of mind in the client to collaborate with us and recognize that this is a different experience than the one that they are having at the time of the beginning of their conversation. So that's why state comes first and strategy and story follow. State of mind is important to address first, because that's going to determine how everything else is processed. So consider the opposite now. If the mentor coach remains in a logical, intellectual frame of mind, perhaps a necessary empathic resonance to connect with a client's emotional experience may be missed. Some additional examples of how at times logic can take a back seat in certain decision making. Brain scans show that when people feel they're being treated unfairly, a portion of the midbrain called the anterior insula lights up and overwhelms the logical considerations of the prefrontal cortex. This is the same kind of disgust that people have when they encounter a rotten apple. Making an example of people like Ken Lay and the prosecution of other executives for their crimes doesn't work and won't work. If it would be sufficient, Ponzi would have been the last needed to teach us the lesson. To make an example is an abstraction. That's not how the emotional brain works. When something bad happens, this is something additional to consider. When something bad happens to someone we envy, the result most often is that we feel good. Neuroscientists at the University of Cambridge found that news of the downfall of the rich and famous activates the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex of the brain. Their humiliation activates this region of the brain that responds to conflict and social rejection. In fact, the study showed that the more we envy someone, the greater the pleasure in their downfall. This accounts for our pleasure in seeing a high-powered executive who earned several million dollars in bonus get humiliated in front of a congressional committee exposing his indiscretion or in doing the perp walk. And think about it. When Bernie Madoff got shoved on the sidewalk that time, be honest, how many times did you rewind? Actually, you probably didn't have to rewind. CNN did it at least a half dozen times. They showed it every time. Another consideration about states of mind, just to think about how some things are determined by states of mind rather than logical decisions. Shopping can change the way you feel. It can be state-changing. When people feel insecure, either emotionally or economically, or down a little bit or want to change the way they feel, they can do that by shopping because the anticipation of spending money changes a state of mind. For the most expensive shops on Madison Avenue, one of their best days in history was the day Lehman Brothers failed. When the going gets tough. And finally, another example. Brain scans show that the pleasure center, the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center of the brain lights up when people consider a purchase. Now, another brain structure activated by pain, the pain center, the insula, lights up when somebody thinks about the cost and having to give up some of their money. So these two brain areas, the pleasure center and the pain center, they compete with each other to determine whether you buy something or not. The pleasure center wins hands down when you segment the purchase from the payment, like with the use of a credit card. The pain of payment is relegated to a theory and to the future, an abstraction that causes no present pain, even to optimism bias. Well, I'm going to have some more money next month, which is why people who spend with a credit card on average spend 23% more than when they pay with cash or check. So let's talk now about choice enhancement. Here are some considerations that apply to emotions and choices. And these are things to consider, to kind of tuck away, to remember when you hear them coming from clients in various ways. One, increased tension produces emotional regression. When there's increased tension, the stress response reaction moves somebody into an emotional pattern that's more characteristic of a much earlier age. An executive woman, a very high-functioning woman, made this statement. I must be doing something wrong. All the things I know to do aren't working. And I ask her, what's the age of that conversation? What age do you feel like when you say it, in other words? And she said, that's exactly how I felt when I was 12 and 13 and 14. Like, everything I did was not where there was nothing I could do that would work. Now, I want to come back to that in a minute. Secondly, increased emotion narrows perspective. This is also what she said. I'm so preoccupied with my portfolio losing value, it's hard to focus on my work. When emotion prevails, focus becomes narrower and more restricted to the most recent event, especially if it's emotionally charged. It's the recency bias. The most recent things get more attention. Paradoxically, attempting to use reason and logic when somebody's escalated emotionally deepens the automatic alarm pattern. If somebody's escalated, they'll further escalate, dig in their toes, and spiral into extreme responses and hurl themselves away from logic if you try to get logical with them. So first you have to address the state. State always comes first. Resonate empathically with the upset. Then begin together to move forward to look at strategy and story or plan. So, when you're in a state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings, to restore a cool state. So, immediately that could be by getting grounded and centered. And I'll discuss a case in just a moment. Another consideration is to lump tasks according to states of mind required to do them. It takes energy to change a state of mind, so clustering similar tasks that require the same state of mind is an efficient strategy. Going back and forth during the same time period to do different things rather than clustering things that are require a similar state of mind can be very draining. For example, if you try to work with a client, do an errand, work, come back, work with a client, do an errand, and continue that, it will be much more efficient to cluster all the times of working with a client together, cluster all the errands together, so that you don't have to switch states of mind so much. It's been said that it takes as much energy to run a TV for 3 to 4 hours as it does to turn it on. The same with states of mind. Anytime you change a state of mind, it takes energy and it can become depleting over time. So another is to learn the optimum state of mind for a particular task. You know, like the time of the day you're most creative for, say, creative writing, and another time of the day, another state of mind entirely for editing. Two different parts of the brain. Now, I want to talk about regulating states of mind. I don't think you have this yet. I will send you the page I have. I have a page printed. I had my graphics person do it so that you'll have a copy of this if you want to work with a client in this way in doing it. And it's called Neural Conditioning to Make Changes That Last. But let's work with that right now, because this is the way I want to illustrate how I would work with a client in regulating states of mind. Now, you're going to get this page, but for right now, let's do a makeshift one. Take a whole sheet of paper and draw three vertical lines so that you have four columns. In the first column, put the heading Emotional Trigger. Second column, the heading is Usual Response or Behavior. Third column is Mantra, to regulate your state of mind by focus and physiology. And fourth column, Ideal Response or Behavior. Now, when I first developed this chart, and this is the single most useful chart that I have for working with clients, and especially with states of mind, I was working with an executive woman who had done a great deal of really exceptional work in coaching, had become a CEO of a mid-sized company, and she had one issue that when she went home for Thanksgiving, or when she went home for a major holiday, she would absolutely lose it. She said, "Dave, I will last not even a day. You know, I have a resolution. I'm not going to get into it this time with it. I'm going to treat this exactly like I do everybody else, but I lose it every time." And this, the first of these, was about to happen when we were working together. And she said, "You know, I can last maybe a half or two thirds of a day, and then I end up, you know, in a fight or in some kind of, you know, I just absolutely ruin the whole rest of the time." What I suggested to her, I asked her, was she aware of certain cues or triggers that would set this in motion? She said, "Well, I think I am." It's, you know, and then she mentioned a couple. I said, "Here's what I'd recommend. One is that you schedule a brainstorming session with yourself. Say to set aside 30 minutes that you won't have any interruption at all, and that you get very grounded and centered. You stay very present, and you reflect on the things that trigger you when you're with your family. Not to recreate it, not to get in those states, but be an observer and observe all the cues or triggers emotionally. You know, like a phrase your mom will say, a way your dad will look, a way your brother will roll his eyes, all the things that you can think of that are triggers. And she said, I've got a dozen already. And I said, schedule that time with yourself, remain an observer, and put all the cues in that first column. In the second column, write what your usual response is, what your usual behavior is, so that you can recognize the purpose of those first two columns is to code your radar to be aware of the cue or the trigger and what the usual response is. Because between the first and the second column usually is about a nanosecond. That first vertical line represents about a nanosecond. That's a state change, because a state change is almost always prompted by some feeling that you don't want to stay with, and you want to, and you create a state change, but you get into a state, which is you get lost in that software program, and you can't logic or figure your way out of it. So trying to think and be logical and be rational in that state is not going to work. So the second thing I suggested to her is that she schedule another brainstorming time and look at how she's going to create those third and fourth column. The best way to regulate a state of mind, to get grounded and centered, the third column is about getting grounded and centered. And the best way to get grounded and centered is to use a focus and a physiology. A focus may be simply a phrase that you say to focus your attention. And the physiology may be simply taking in a deep breath, a breathing in relaxation and breathing out tension. Now, the third part of a mantra is you need a cue, a trigger. So let me give you an idea. A mantra that I use before a keynote is that I put my index finger and my thumb together on both hands so that I have two little circles, and then I put them together in the middle so I have a little infinity sign. At the same time, I say a phrase, relaxed and powerful. And during this, I'm taking two breaths, one deep breath in for relaxation and breathing out any tension, and repeating it. So in 5 or 6 seconds with this mantra, I'm in an optimum state to do my keynote. Let me give you an example of an application of this mantra. The new head basketball coach at Southern University inherited a team that Southern Utah University, inherited a team that was 217th out of 217 in free shot percentage. So the first thing he did was to institute a mantra so that each time anyone got to the free shot line and before they shot, he suggested that they do this three part, the cue of dribbling the basketball twice, the focus of focusing on a phrase like relaxed and smooth, but he emphasized that they each do their own, so it would really be theirs, and to take a deep breath in for relaxation and breathing out any tension. So the cue, the focus, the physiology, before they shot. Now, in addition, he would suddenly blow the whistle during a practice and have them go to the free shot line, because in a real game, this simulates the pressure, because you're just fouled, you're on tilt, because somebody's fouled you, then you have to go to the line and weigh. You're having all the negative pressure at home, all the positive energy. So every time they made two, they got to take a breather. If they missed either, they had to take a lap. So after 2 years, they were first out of 217 teams in free shot percentage. So this is the mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology. And then the fourth column is to write the ideal behavior, exactly what you would like to do instead of getting into that second column. So the idea of the first two columns is to cue your radar to be more aware of it and to be aware of it ultimately instantly. And the third and fourth column is to rewire your brain, to get grounded and centered so that you have the option of then choosing consciously that fourth column. Now, by the time you do this enough and have for each emotional trigger or cue a response that you have pre-planned and act on to create an ideal response, when you do that enough, it will rewire your brain because you're creating a new link in your hippocampus, which is where meaning is attached. That's the site of the unconscious, because that's what attaches meaning. And an emotional cue or trigger begins a new association to get to that ideal response. So the brain is rewired. Now, any thoughts or questions about that? And that it's a simple concept, but in the beginning it kind of is a little bit challenging. Does that make sense, and are there any questions about it?
Yeah, I like the structure, the trigger, the old response, and then the mantra, recreating something, creating something new, and then create an ideal response. So the structure does work. I do have a question about something earlier, if this is the time now to ask you a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Earlier you mentioned that when you listen to when you're talking to a client, you don't want to be on a logical state or frame of mind. You want to talk to them in the right brain.
Let me clarify that. I didn't say you don't want to be logical. I said if a client has an emotional charge or is upset or has something that they're presenting that's emotionally based in any way, you don't want to begin with logic. You want to begin by empathically resonating with that client so that you do two things by that. You create a common ground, and you help the client regulate so that they're able to consider moving ahead and looking at a strategy and a story with you.
Okay.
Let me give you a couple of extreme examples. Two or three times only in a decade, I've had a client who would begin a session by talking about something that was really upsetting and saying they thought they needed to maybe reschedule at a time where they could really give more attention to the coaching session. And I ask if, before that, would they like to spend just a couple of minutes doing a relaxation exercise? And they inevitably said sure. So we did a progressive relaxation exercise, took about a minute and a half, and inevitably the client said, you know, I really would like to consider how I got off on this, and I feel great about working on this and feel like I really need to. So my belief is the most important thing of that entire session happened in those first 2 minutes, with the client developing and internalizing a model of how to self-regulate, because once we do it together, then they can internalize that model. If a client is a bit upset or a bit preoccupied or worried or something has happened that's been upsetting, if you mention in the beginning, you know, I hear how upsetting that was to you, or I understand how preoccupying that can be, the client feels understood and can kind of exhale then and relax into being more of their true self and to engage with you in a more collaborative way. So even in a subtle way, state always comes first, and that creates a common ground for you both to proceed to look at and understand how you can develop their story a bit more. Does that clarify now?
Yeah. You explained it to me now, and I get it. My question at that time was on the statement you you made that, you know, you need to right brain communication. And my question is like, how do you switch from a logical to right brain communication? But I get it now by empathizing with them.
And ideally, you do both. You may want to lead with the right brain. You may want to lead with that empathic comment, but you're going to collaboratively proceed in a balanced way, and balanced in terms of left brain and right brain, because both are important. Someone will be, when you're totally present, totally regulated, and totally present, grounded, and centered, there's a balance of right and left brain. You have access to all of your states of mind. You have access to all of your intuitive and empathic and reasoning capacity. If there's a skew in one direction or the other, there's a limitation of access. If you're skewed by more right brain, of being more emotional about something, you may lose a bit of access to logic and intellect and reason. Or if you're really upset emotionally, your right brain can seize and hold hostage your left brain. If you're more in your left brain about thinking about something, worrying about it, ruminating, you know, in a negative thought loop, then you're more in your left brain and you may lose the balance and the access to the right brain. So what we want to do is restore that balance, because optimum decisions are made in a balance of right and left brain, so that it's a seamless integration and not like one or the other.
Yeah. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other thoughts or comments? So in my view then, and I'll send you this, the neural conditioning chart. In my view, the most important thing that we can do to achieve success is to manage our emotions and regulate states of mind. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain, Philip Seymour Hoffman. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. Now, think about how your state of mind determines the meaning you attach. You're at home with your, and we've touched on this before, but I want to reiterate this now that we're talking about this. You're at home, you've just had a great evening, a great dinner with your partner, you're having a glass of wine, and there's a sound in the backyard that you probably don't even register it. If you register it, it's like, you know, it'll go away. Now, same place, next evening, you're home alone. You've just watched the last episode of Criminal Minds. It's Wednesday. Don't ask me how I know. You hear the same noise outside, and suddenly you're in a state of alert. You're checking it. You're vigilant. You're wondering and have a little bit of concern about your safety. Your state of mind determines the meaning you attach to something, and the meaning you attach determines your behavior. So that's why state always comes first and is most important. So, again, the two best ways to regulate your state of mind, physiology, how you use your body, and focus, what and how you focus on. Now, we're always asking ourselves questions. Why does this always happen to me? Why am I overweight? Think about how, when you first wake up, you immediately determine your state of mind by the first question you ask. If there's something that's preoccupying you, you ask a question. Well, what's going to happen now? How's that going to affect me today? Or what do I have to worry about today? Or if you're really looking forward to something, your first question is, man, this is going to be great. What a great time I'm going to have today. So we're always asking ourselves questions. So the key is to ask a better question. Let me give you an example. A couple of one executive and one a business owner who were at a Vistage group that I was guest at, and I was an invited guest because there were a couple of people, notably, and then some others who were having difficulty with stress, and this two incidents at each of their companies, an incident at each of their two companies, had determined a great deal of stress for them and their companies, and there was an entire effect throughout the system. And what we did then, after what we just did in terms of this neural conditioning chart, was that I mentioned to them a piece of homework that I would like them to do. And I pointed out that every time we get up, we, before we even are fully conscious of it, we're always asking ourselves questions, as I just mentioned. I suggested to them, and these questions determine the state of mind for the next several hours. Just like if you get up and you stub your toe, you're going to have a bad morning because your state of mind is already set. So I said one way to determine that, to establish your state of mind and to regulate that, is to, before you go to bed or sometime in the preceding day, write down three questions that would empower you, put you in an optimum state of mind, a peak state. And when you get up, first thing, as soon as you turn on your bedside lamp, before you're even completely awake, grab that paper and answer those three questions. And remember to write down questions that are empowering and put you in a peak state. And when they reported back on that, they said in the first 3 days, their state had changed, and they were able to change some things in their company because they were thinking about and looking at things from the very beginning in a different way. So if something's not working, change your state. Change the questions you ask. And this aspect of regulating states of mind, I think, is a really important thing to consider in terms of how you can get to a peak performance state. And think about a peak performance for a keynote may be very different than when you're planning to jog or when you're planning to go to sleep. A peak state there would be to move into a state of optimum relaxation, to be able to be even more effective at going to sleep and going to sleep more quickly. So look at what your state of mind is, because that's going to determine also what your focus is. A phrase that puts you in a peak state for relaxation is going to need to take that into account, as opposed to a phrase that puts you in a peak state for a performance. So let me give one more example of let me first check because I was going to give an example of a case study, but are there questions or aspects of the ideas here and the application that would be more helpful to talk about? Well, let me give an example about a case in a sort of a different way here. A client was a successful CPA who functioned really, really well when he focused and became immersed on a specific task. But his challenge was that if there were any external distractions, he got derailed, and he had trouble moving from task to task, project to project during the day in a kind of continuity. Now, what we discovered was that he had an attention deficit, so he needed to do some things to really give a specific focus to what he was doing. So for him, regulation of state of mind became a very specific task and a crucial aspect of what he did. So for him, self-regulation involved establishing an entire daily schedule so that he had a map for the day so he could look exactly where he was and he wouldn't get lost in it. So I suggested that he keep a daily, hourly calendar to the left of his computer so that he could look and see his entire day. And I knew he worked at an IMAX, so he had a large margin on either side. So he could do a sticky note and write down his schedule for the entire day so he knew exactly where he was and what he was doing, what his plan and structure was for that hour so he didn't get lost. And on the right, a sticky note that specifically was next best action. Every hour he would write what he was to do that hour, next best action. So he always had a map of where he was. So for his daily schedule, he learned to schedule blocks of uninterrupted time to sustain a state of mind. Remember, when he concentrated, he worked better than anyone. And what we did to preserve that time was to ensure that he was not interrupted, that his secretary or his assistant would screen all calls, that nobody would drop by, nobody would interrupt him, and he could schedule that time to be fully immersed, and that things that he did that required a different state of mind, the same states of mind would be scheduled together, like the curbside consults and the meeting with his partners. And the things like that, that and returning telephone calls could be scheduled at a particular time of the day. So to cluster the activities that require the same state of mind were very important. So what he did then was learn to not only regulate his state of mind, but to decide what state of mind works best for what, and to create a structure in which those were protected and in which those were clustered, so that he became immensely effective then in doing what he did and found a way to regulate that involved his external structure as well as his internal self-regulation. So your other thoughts and questions? Any other thoughts, questions, things that would be helpful for us to talk about?
It's a thought more than a question, Dave.
I feel like
my previous job is suddenly making so much more sense to me, where I was able to thrive and or when I was able to thrive and when I wasn't. So much of it was because of the dramatic difference in roles and tasks that I needed to play.
And that shift, I
could feel it. Trying to explain it to somebody is very difficult, but to hear it validated and to be able to work with people going forward in that is exciting for me, because I know very, very frustrating for me in that old life and not necessarily having somebody that truly believed that it was real.
And they don't have to. You know, when you get to the position of recognizing that they don't have to, the important thing, the necessary component, is that you do. Because you're writing your own story now. And if someone doesn't agree with you, well, that's a point of view. Let me tell you a story that illustrates this, and you're free to use this phrase whenever you would like. I was at a board of directors meeting, and it was a very charged issue that was being discussed, and the main proponent of the change that was happening, an older guy who was there who became very impassioned about it, and his closing remark, he got up and walked the entire distance around the entire table of the board of directors, waving his hand, getting louder and louder. And as he sat down, slammed both hands on the table and said, "This is what we have to do." And the very wise chairperson said, "That is a point of view. Now, we'll hear some others." So anytime anybody doesn't agree with you or doesn't agree with you vigorously, I hear your point of view. That's it. You don't have to defend. You don't have to justify or rationalize or convince somebody. Remember the principle of putting your energy into what you can determine, that's your story.
Mm-hmm.
And letting go of what you can't determine, that's how somebody else responds. All the way from that out to the ozone level.
I think the big thing is helping folks. In my situation, I remember, because I didn't know what to do with it. I knew it was real. I wanted someone to believe and to hear me.
Sure.
Because I wanted to be able to do something with it. I wanted to write a new story, but I didn't know how. It's recognizing that, and maybe helping others recognize that in others part of my practice. But,
now that you know it, you can be even more effective in helping
mm-hmm.
others and helping others in a significant way.
Yeah, that's very
Absolutely.
Exciting for me.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I know we're a minute over. Thank you so much for all of your energy and investment and contribution. It really brings it alive. I look forward to picking up right here next time, and I'll send you the attachment for the neural condition chart. Bye.
Thank you, Dave.
Have a great rest of the week. See you guys.
You too.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.